goes for thousand pounds and possible pounds.
And the second that could run the station. I appear for those three submitted today, and I'm aware that a few of them Ms. Rosie Hill.
Right, well, Mrs. Hill
now. Has come across to learn a bit about the Wanaka side of the district. My legal submissions, sir, were I lodged a synopsis. I have today circulated an updated version of that document in hard copy. And I have also had that emailed through to the DP Hearings panel in Word, in case it's of any use down the track. And to assist you, given that you will presumably have read the synopsis, where I have made changes in this document, I'll put yellow highlight.
Thank you.
So the yellow highlighting is the
new bits.
The new bits or the change bits. And these submissions are lodged on behalf of LMB Farms Limited, and commissioners who may not know, Mr. and Mrs. Cluse sitting behind me at LMB Farms Limited, and I think Commissioner Robinson mentioned on Tuesday that he recently read the recent North Lake decision. LMB Farms Limited is one of the three major landowners involved in that plan change. And LMB Farms has been responsible for a lot of the subdivision of land in the northern part of Wanaka over the past 35 years. Crosshill Farm Limited owns land across the Clutha River from Allenby Farms and North Lake on the other side of the Clutha River. Their interests relate to the fact that part of their land is the rural landscape classification. And Mount Cadrona Station Limited owns land in Mount Cadrona Station. Part of their land is a special zone which is not part of Stage 1, but they own other land outside that, which is in the rural general zone, outstanding natural landscape category, so they have interest in ONL issues. It's been a bit of a working out how to present my submissions, commissioners, given that I have clients on both sides of the hill interested in all these topics. So what I've tried to do, and I'm going to try and stick to it, is submissions today are about ONL and Wanaka urban growth boundary issues. Next Tuesday, I'm focusing on urban growth boundary issues in Queenstown. And then on Thursday, I'm giving legal submissions on rural landscape issues. So although Crosshill here today has rural landscape interests, and part of Mr. Duncan White's evidence is on rural landscape issues, my legal submissions on that come next Thursday. To avoid repetition. Turning, sir, to page one of my submissions, and the first four paragraphs you will see repeated in all of my legal submissions, so I'll just briefly touch on them this once, and then I won't go back to them. I wanted to highlight paragraph 1.2 and reiterate my understanding is that the responsibility of counsel and witnesses is to assist you to achieve optimum outcomes. Obviously, representing our client's interests, that we have almost a higher responsibility to work with you to help sort out the district plan. And 1.3 is the scope issue. The difficulty facing any individual submitter is that scope is governed by all of the submissions lodged. So I've taken the deliberate approach and I've instructed my witnesses accordingly. I've told them not to worry too much about what's in the submission or worry about scope, but just to turn their mind to what they believe to be the best outcome and give this panel the benefit of their professional advice. And I'm reasonably confident on all these issues that there have been so many submissions lodged across the board that it's highly unlikely that anything's out of scope on the issues that we're talking about. If you look at the people who want the submissions who want the existing regime to stay, right through to us notified, right through to all of the submissions, they're very broad. So going down to 2.1, I'm going to cover some specific UGB issues in relation to Allenby, but first it is necessary to consider the wider picture in relation to UGBs in general and the Wanaka UGB in particular. And in part of this submission is it's two halves. It's half here and half next Tuesday. It's just a deal of Wanaka and Queenstown separately, but kind of at the same time. In my submission, helps understand what some of the issues are about urban growth boundaries, which I've spent quite a bit of time thinking about. So in part, what I'm about to say is the first part of what I'll be saying next Tuesday. Going over to page paragraph 2.2.
Excuse me, Mr. Goldsmith. I wonder if I could trouble you, if I could just check something with the chair. Do you mind if I, first of all, ask the chair if he minds if I interrupt you, and secondly, I will ask you if you mind if I interrupt you.
Mr. Goldsmith is used to me interrupting him. He's a submission, so I'm sure he won't mind if you do.
We have almost had one. Down here, iterative words. Yes.
So, having stopped you in mid-flow, I was interested in your reliance on Simon's Hill, which I was, of course, aware of. Can you point me to any environment court authority holding those principles that His Honour Justice Gendall found in Simon's Hill apply at first instance? Because clearly what he was considering was reviewing the Environment Court's consideration of a forest and bird argument on appeal.
Yes. But as I read the High Court judgment, it was talking about a scope in terms of a hearing, and the scope in terms of that hearing was bounded by all of the submissions lodged on that issue. At the end of the day, the Environment Court sits carrying out the same function and with the same, I think, breadth and scope that happens at the level below. So, I mean, I'll think this through further for next Tuesday, but I couldn't see why or how the scope would be broader higher up than it is at the lower level.
I'm not disagreeing with you, I just want to understand your logic.
Yes. I hadn't turned my mind to any difference between the Environment Court and first instance. I will think about it. Again, I'm back next Tuesday. But it was like my immediate reaction is, how could the scope be any lower at this level than it is at the Environment Court?
You could take the argument, perhaps, that our scope could only shrink by virtue of what's put an issue in the notices of appeal.
Mm. Correct. As it goes up, it can shrink. But I don't think it can get larger.
So, as I say, think on. I just wanted to test that initial premise.
I will. Someone's making a note. She'll be looking at it eagerly. So 2.2, I submit that the Wanaka UGB, even from the outset of looking at it, is a logical and common sense example of the application of the urban growth boundary concept. I'll sort of talk briefly about the Auckland, what is the rural urban boundary, and its, in my submission, similarities to Wanaka. And I have been involved, commissioners, in hearings on the Auckland rural urban boundary, and in fact, I have two hearings next week. So we've been grappling with those issues in Auckland. And in a broad sense, where I believe there's a similarity is Auckland is, I'm going to use an analogy here, it's like an amoeba. It's a big blob with edges, it's a funny shaped amoeba, but it's a big amoeba trying to grow. And running through the amoeba are, shall we say, veins or arteries, which are the infrastructure, the sewage and the water and the railways and so on. So in Auckland, the two issues they're dealing with are, firstly, is that the amoeba is trying to spread. It's trying to go out across the productive fertile lands that surround Auckland, and that's a whole issue as to whether it should be allowed to, because the pressure inside is pushing it out. And the second issue in Auckland is infrastructure, and are there veins or arteries there to supply the nutrients to the amoeba to allow it to grow?
Not the same ones
to
have sewage and stormwater.
Sorry?
But they're not the same
ones. No, probably not the same, no. But, you know, it's got to go in, it's got to come out. Interestingly, commissioners, and this may be relevant to your deliberations, given you've got 18 months to come up with final recommendations. In Auckland, the RUB, which is based upon a 70-40 split, 70% inside the RUB, 40% of future growth outside the RUB, and a line drawn on a map, the outset there was actually no link in the evidence between the location of the line and the 7040. And the panel actually asked the council to go away and produce capacity projections, capacity studies and growth projections to show how the rub related to the 7040 split and how there was a connection. And the second thing that happened was that the line, there wasn't much evidence about why the line was where it was in terms of infrastructure. So again, the council was sent away to go away and will come back to us with evidence as to why you want to stage it the way you do and why there are infrastructural issues. Bringing that, those principles and some of the points I'm going to raise that the panel may consider at some point the desirability of asking council for more information on some of the things, because my submission that I'll get to, you do not have some of the information you need to make some of the decisions you need to make. Bringing that back to Wanaka, in a sense, very similar. Wanaka's in a meter, it's a single blob. Its issues are with the amoeba growing, the blob spreading across flat, fertile land that should or shouldn't be used for urban development. And then, secondly, within the amoeba, are there veins or arteries? Is the infrastructure in place to actually allow the growth to happen? And related to that, should that infrastructure be allowed to extend across boundaries and spread, or shouldn't it? So there's a lot of similarities between Auckland and Wanaka and those two big picture principles. And just touching briefly on what I'm going to say, talk about next week, because I need to make the comparison now. The same cannot be said for the Wakatipu Basin. It has a fundamentally different pattern of urban growth. It's nothing like Wanaka, and it's nothing like Auckland. And again, just to alert you to a different analogy I'm going to raise next week, I'm going to submit to you that in the Wakatipu Basin, we don't have an amoeba, we have an orange tree. And the base of that analogy is that the trunks and the branches are the infrastructure. In the Wakatipu Basin, it's all there, it's all in place. You can do urban development anywhere in the Wakatipu Basin, there are no infrastructural constraints. But urban growth in the Wakatipu Basin doesn't happen as one big blob growing. It happens, and historically has happened, in a whole bunch of different discrete areas. Sunshine Bay, Fern Hill, there's downtown Queenstown is an area, there's Franklin is an area, there's Jack's Point is an area, there's Arthur's Point is an area, there's Arrowtown is an area. Kind of like oranges on an orange tree. The urban growth is not continuous or contiguous. It's a whole bunch of different, it's a completely different pattern. And in the Wakatipu, the question is, should there be any more oranges? Now, the reason I make that comparison at 3.4 is in my submission, this fundamental difference in urban growth creates significant problems for the overarching urban growth policies in part 4.2.2. And the problem is that the overarching policies are trying to create and support an amoeba and an orange tree. And they're fundamentally different. And therefore, you end up with policies at the top coming out of two completely different outcomes. And that creates problems with the policies at the top. And the reason I raise that is to the extent that the Wanaka urban growth boundary depends upon those policies at the top, if they're weak or flawed, then that undermines the strength of the Wanaka urban growth boundary. So I look at, I've quoted 4.2.2. I'm going to leave the objective there for the minute. And I've highlighted that there are five policies in this section. I'm going to address two today and three next Tuesday. But 4.2.2.1, which talks about urban growth boundaries, defining the limits of urban growth and ensuring that urban growth is contained within those identified boundaries, that's avoided outside, right now has a fundamental problem because it works for Wanaka, but when we get to talk about Queenstown, as that policy stands at the moment and as the facts on the ground are at the moment, there are urban growth areas outside, there are urban growth areas outside the urban growth boundaries. Ayrburn, Waterfall Park, there are areas that are zoned for urban growth which are not inside the currently identified urban growth boundaries. So, subject to the outcome of this hearing, at the moment there's a disconnect, a factual disconnect, which undermines 4.2.2.1. 4.2.2.2 is even worse, because it talks about urban growth boundaries of a scale and form which is consistent with the anticipated demand for urban development over the planning period. Now, my first question is, what is the planning period? Is it 10 years, because that should be the life of the district plan? Is it 20 years, which is actually the life of the district plan? The ODP was notified in October 1995, and this one was notified in August 2015. 2 months, 3 months short of 20 years. Or is it a longer period? I haven't read, in all the stuff that I've read, any evidence which provides you with a link between the growth patterns of the urban growth boundaries. Now, this council has capacity figures, it has growth figures, but I haven't seen any evidence put to you that says this urban growth boundary in particular is allowing for this particular planning period. There's no link in the evidence between the location of the urban growth boundaries and the projected growth.
Mr. Goldsmith,
yes?
Before you appear on Tuesday, assuming it's available, I suggest you listen to the transcript of our discussion with Mr. Pates yesterday.
I came for day one. I'd like to have been there for Mr. Barr and Mr. Pates, but I have two major hearings in Auckland next week and two major Queensland hearings, so I had to go ahead and do some submissions. But I will. Is the transcript actually available? Can we?
It will be available tomorrow.
And you will find if you get some tax commissions that the Wanaka Urban Growth Boundaries got about 40 years growth inside it. Arrowtown's got about 5. Arthur's Point's got maybe 5. Queenstown's got 30 or 40 or 50. They're all over the place. So this vague reference to a planning period actually doesn't help anybody achieve anything. And therefore, it's a very weak policy. Now, 2.5, I'll be the other half of this next Tuesday. I'm just putting a query to you as to whether an overarching suite of UG policies is needed, actually needed to inform the specific ones below. So my submission, the 5 on the top, the other 3 add about as much as those 2. They do not assist you at all in determining the appropriate solution. 2.6, I make the point that while the council evidence and relation infrastructure adequately supports most of the objective 4.2.3, it provides no meaningful support to the identified UGBs, either in Wanaka or in Queenstown, or in Wakatipu. And again, just I'm going to develop that next week. But that evidence contains a lot of motherhood and apple pie statements about urban growth boundaries can assist councils to plan for urban growth. Nowhere in Mr. Blair's evidence was there any evidence that I read that said this particular urban growth boundary is in this particular location because it was an infrastructural constraint. There's no link between the infrastructure evidence and the urban growth boundaries. So that evidence, in my submission, doesn't actually help you in any way in locating the UGBs.
Mr. Goldsmith,
yes?
Another thing I should alert you to, Glasner, was unfortunately ill and unable to present his evidence. So what we have done is give him a series of written questions seeking a written answer. That the point you've just raised is one of those written questions.
Yeah, thank you, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Goldsmith, when you were talking earlier about the Wanaka had 40 years growth, Queenstown had 5.
Arrowtown
had 5, and those other. Do we have any evidence for those numbers? Where did they come from?
30 years working in this district, sir. Which is why I appreciate that's almost evidence. I don't think it's my client's job to produce all that evidence, but I am aware, and I think Councillor Cox will be able to confirm, having been involved in the PC45 Northlake debate, where infrastructure was a big issue, there was quite a lot of debate about how much growth there was in Wanaka, how many years it was planned for, one of the arguments against North Lake was there's already 25 years growth here, we don't need it. North Lake was approved on top of that. So the council does actually have residential capacity analysis of all its areas, and it does have growth rates. And if you ask the question, I'm sure it would be able to give you the answers, which I probably shouldn't be giving legal submissions. I just happen to live there. Having been involved in a number of cases like that, I've just briefed and read a lot of evidence on that subject in Wanaka in particular. And the Queenstown figure, if you look at all the densification planned through this district plan review, then I've got no idea what the capacity is in Queenstown, in the Queenstown urban growth boundary. But Arrowtown is really constrained. So if it's 10 years, it's lucky. Now, 2.7, I make the point that the generic nature of that evidence possibly overlooks a genuine justification for wanting a new GB. I'm aware there are infrastructure constraints on this side of the hill, and it may well be that there is a good reason for the Wanaka UGB in infrastructure. But my submission, you haven't got the evidence, but I take it you've asked for it. 2.8, I then come down from the overarching ones to the UGB, specific Wanaka UGB policies. And my submission, they don't reflect the rationale for Wanaka UGB based upon prior planning exercises. I think this is probably should be mentioned in your Section 32 documentation, commissioners, but it was the Wanaka land need study, the Wanaka commercial land need study, the Wanaka structure plan 2004, the Wanaka transportation study, the Wanaka structure plan 2007. There's five or six of them over the last decade. And in my submission, they are so generic that they provide little support for the Wanaka UGB. And I just want to copy them out here. Minor comment about the objective, manage the scale and location of urban growth in the Wanaka urban growth boundary. But that objective doesn't relate to any of the following policies. I think the objective is meant to say by means of an urban growth boundary or using an urban growth boundary, not in. Going down to the policies, the rural character of key entrances to the town is retained and protected as provided by the natural boundaries of the Clutha River and the Cadrona River. Now, reading it, you'd think rural character, key entrance, two rivers, that means bridges. And in fact, of the three entries into Wanaka, the two State Highway 6 entries are across a bridge. But the key landscape, key rural entry to Wanaka that I just drove in, which is the one most susceptible to urban growth, the Cadrona Valley entrance, because of the flat land rolling straight out, has nothing to do with the Clutha River or the Cadrona River. So in fact, this is the only policy of these four policies that refers to Wanaka. And it, by the way it's worded, it misses the most susceptible key entrance. And what I think has happened, commissioners, is rural character of key entrances to Wanaka is an important issue, and the natural boundaries of those two rivers is an important issue. Those two things have been mashed together in one policy, and you've ended up with a flawed policy because it misses one of the three. The next one is a distinction between urban and rural areas is maintained to protect the quality and character of the environment and visual amenity. Well, that's a pretty generic kind of not Wanaka-related statement that couldn't appear in any district plan. Ad hoc development of rural land is avoided. Well, with respect, an urban growth boundary doesn't stop ad hoc development of rural land. It might stop ad hoc urban development of rural land, but it doesn't stop the kind of ad hoc development that can pepper pot around the edge of a town, like pepper pot spots on that map on the wall. And an outside natural landscape and natural features are protected from encroachment by urban development. Again, a general statement. In reality, it adds nothing to the objectives and policies found elsewhere in this plan that protect ONLs and ONX. Doesn't actually add anything. And it's not specific. If you look at Wanaka, and you look at a map of Wanaka, the Wanaka urban area only abounds an ONL.
The only place that the ONL about Wanaka is along the base of the old fen. That's the only bit that is protected by that policy. So, given that, why not be specific and talk about the base of the Alpha Fan?
Mr. Goldsmith, I take your point that the policy may not be complete or accurate. Would you agree, though, that where there are no distinguishing landscape elements, assuming the technique of specifying an urban growth boundary were applied, it would be legitimate to take the view that it has to go somewhere, and however arbitrary, this is the line on the map. Another decision maker might have a different line, but in the first instance, council might say this far and no further. In the same way that a lot of water quality limits are specified to very exact numerical standards, where the exactness cannot be justified on effects grounds, and the courts have held that, yes, it's arbitrary, but it has to go somewhere. And that's as good as anywhere.
Firstly, I accept what you've said completely. Secondly, and you may have misunderstood where I'm going with this, my client's actually very supportive of what I've written growth boundary. My concern I'm trying to express to you is I think it hasn't been well done. And I'm going to suggest to you how I think it could be a lot better done. And going back to your point is quite correct. It will be my strong submission in Wanaka, there is no need to have to resort to an arbitrary boundary. There's a lot of good reasons for the Wanaka urban growth boundary. They just aren't stated in this plan. That's my concern. And I believe that that section could be rewritten in a way that would make it far stronger and far more effective. So this is kind of my hat on trying to help Wanaka urban growth boundary. Because please don't read this as an attack on urban growth boundaries in general. There are some issues about some of the Queenstown ones. As a technique, it's entirely valid. And it's dead right from Wanaka. And I'll finish on this. This is what I'm getting to. If attention was focused on issues which are specific to Wanaka, and if the drafting exercise was informed by the various community planning documents which culminated in the Wanaka Structure Plan 2007, which commissioners, I know some commissioners will have read it, but it's available there and it's a very good read. A suite of Wanaka-specific UGB policies in my submission could be drafted, which would create a much stronger rationale and support for a Wanaka UGB. Such policies could include, and I've made a list, a policy acknowledging and referencing the extensive Wanaka community planning process over the past decade. And it could be, actually, it could be an objective, to implement the vision for Wanaka developed by the Wanaka community through the planning process which culminated in the Wanaka Structure Plan 2007. If you wrote that down and it was in here, then it would provide a basis. The second one, you have a policy specifically identifying the urban growth threat which Wanaka faces. Again, if I can go to the map, Dr. Reed even answered a question, identified it for you. She said, Wanaka's here. Blackland, the upper inner to the basin is here. So the threat here is going out there. So a policy could say to avoid uncontrolled urban sprawl across the flatlands of the upper inner to the basin. It could be a Wanaka-centric, Wanaka-specific policy. You could have a policy identifying and referencing any structure constraints relevant to a Wanaka UGB, I don't know what those are. You have a policy referencing any specific adjoining ONL which requires additional protection. That's the alpha, the base of the Alpha Fan, or the Alpha Mount Alpha, I think it's called. But I've missed one out. A policy specifically identifying and protecting the key rural entries in the Wanaka that gets all three of them and not just two of them.
a policy specifically identifying the time period being planned for. That one, I could both about is planning for something like 40 years growth. Surely there should be a policy which says that. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to plan for 40 years growth. And possibly a policy addressing intended or desirable limitations on extension of the one of the UGB junior identified planning period. A policy could say, that is it for 40 years, we'll readdress it in two generations' time. And then I said it's kind of the wrong way around, having drafted those policies, go back and draft a more focused objective, which is actually an objective rather than just a reference to a method. So my submission to conclude, the drafting exercise I've described above could achieve the following. The policy outcome would be Wanaka-centric, based clearly and firmly upon Wanaka-related issues. Development of the policies would validate the UGB concept as being an appropriate method to address Wanaka growth issues. Because if you went through all of those policies, what drops out of it is an urban growth boundary. It's kind of a, it's a consequence of the policies as opposed to a starting point. Sorry, I've just realised I forgot another one. There should be a policy specifically identifying the clearly defined topographical boundaries that Wanaka wants to be contained within. Lake Wanaka, Clutha River, Cadrona River, and the base of the Mount Alpha Fan. They could all be named in a policy. And if you did that, you end up with a UGB concept that is apparent, and I'm thinking of the hypothetical newly appointed Auckland Environment Court judge who comes down to sit on a challenge to the Wanaka growth boundary and has this suite of policies that in themselves tell a story and explain everything and make it easy for that judge to understand it. And I think if you achieve that, your Wanaka urban growth boundary will be far more robust and far more defendable than, in my submission, it currently is, because of the weaknesses in the policies I've pointed out. And it's a very simple exercise then to take out the word Wanaka and put in the word Arrowtown and do the same exercise again. You end up with a completely different suite of policies, but they'll be Arrowtown centric. That's my kind of broad thing on urban growth boundaries. Commissioners, I hope there's some assistance. And I'll pick up on the Queenstown side of the Wakatipu Basin side of things next Tuesday when Jeff Brown's going to be announced. Moving on to the more specific issue which that was raised in the LMB submission in particular, the review contains conflicting provisions relevant to the issue of whether the UGB can contain an ONF or whether the purpose of the UGB is to protect an ONF. I've listed there the majority of policy provisions which appear to support ONFs being within an urban growth boundary. Listed them there, commissioners, I assume you have read them, so I won't read them all out. But there are four policies there which quite clearly support the concept that a standing natural feature, such as Mount Iron, is inside an urban growth boundary. And then, going over the page, there's even a specific Wanaka one that says ensure that development within the Wanaka urban growth boundary does not diminish the qualities of significant landscape features. So that would appear to anticipate you've got a significant landscape feature inside the UGB. But then there's one policy provision which suggests the opposite, and that's the generic one that says ONLs and ONFs are protected from encroachment by urban development. I'm pointing out here the inconsistency. Then I've noted that this inconsistent treatment of this issue in the policy provisions is reflected in the relevant UGB boundaries. I'm sorry, I made an incorrect map reference in my first draft. Mount Iron, on plan map 18, is excluded. And then I've actually said, or partially included and partially excluded. Now, the later hearing commissions, we're going to get onto the mapping of Mount Iron. But I hope that Mount Iron can be pointed out to the two commissioners from outside, but Mount Iron is a very, very, very distinctive feature. It's a big volcanic rock sitting in a plain. It stands out for miles. But on the northern side of it, there's a residential zone that goes part way out.
It's not volcanic.
Glacial. It's the remains of it.
You're thinking of Auckland.
My mistake. It's a big hard lump of rock that the glacier couldn't move.
Yeah.
And rolled over the top of. But it's got residual development that goes part way up. So it's kind of weird because as a feature, it's obvious. Mount Iron's got houses on part of it. But the fact that it's got houses on part of it doesn't take away from the fact that it's now a natural feature, which has got some houses on part of it. But at the moment, the ONF boundary kind of goes up and around the houses and down again, so they're only part of the features in our seeing natural feature. It's kind of strange. So it's partially included and partially excluded. The Hikawai Conservation Area on Planning Map 18 is excluded. Doesn't make any sense at all. Fairlies Hill, which is an arrow town, in the middle of arrow town, is included in the UGB. And just to complicate matters, Deer Park Heights Peninsula Hill on Planning Map 13, it's half inside the UGB and it's half outside the UGB. So there's just a consistency issue here. 3.4, I say, an ONF is generally an isolated and distinct feature located within a wider area or wider landscape. It's generally perceived as being part of the wider area or wider landscape, like Mount Iron is. I say Mount Iron is as much a part of wider Wanaka urban area as Fairlies Hill is part of the Arrowton urban area, perhaps more so given the fact that there's residential development on it. And that excluding Mount Iron from the Wanaka UGB is both illogical and unnecessary. It should be inside, just as Fairlies Hill is included inside. And when we come to look at the maps, that becomes even more obvious.
Mr. Goldsmith?
Yes?
Take your consistency point. My question for you is whether an ONF is within or without the UGB. Isn't the critical thing to ensure that, in terms of 6C, that the ONF is protected?
Absolutely.
And therefore, to the extent that the policies enable and encourage urban development within urban growth boundaries, that is necessarily going to have to be an exception to that.
Yes, and going back to the policies I quoted at the foot of the previous page, a specific policy that creates the ability for exceptions. I'm not in any way suggesting the protection of the ONF should be reduced, because as I come on to say in 3.6, the DBR contains strong objectives and policies which protect ONFs and address the potential for development of ONFs. I say there's no need for protection of an ONF to be part of the rationale for a UGB. And over the page I go on to say I've added, however, if it is considered that Mount Iron requires additional policy protection, that can be addressed later through specific policy protection. What I'm saying is that urban growth boundaries are a concept that are there for a primary reason. They don't need to be confused with subsidiary reasons, like protecting ONFs, where there's other ways of protecting the ONF. And obviously, LLB has some plans, we're going to come back along and talk about that in great detail. It's just a matter of principle that an ONF in the middle of an urban area is action part, even if there's nothing on it, like Fairlies Hill and Arrowtown.
Is it, Mr. Goldsmith? My understanding is that it's standard planning practice when you're going through constraint mapping and that kind of thing. And as Commissioner Robinson said, take account of your consistency issues. But would it not be that if you were trying to undertake constraint mapping, that you would exclude them from those areas? Might be a question for Mr. White.
Well, if you go, let's go back to Auckland. Auckland's a big place with a big rural urban boundary, and in the middle of it, it's got Mount Eden and all sorts of places that can't be touched. And they're not kind of excluded because they can't be touched. The urban growth boundary has a function to prevent spread, to ensure infrastructure, and inside it, there are areas that will be reserves and parks and outstanding natural features and rivers and lakes. Inside there, that they are part of the urban area, even if they're given the most top-level protection possible, they are still logically part of the urban area. And I'm just submitting to you that Mount Iron is, well, when we come to the mapping, we'll be saying
At that point, we'll say it's logically part of the urban area. At this point, I'm just, at the policy level, pointing out that this plan treats this issue inconsistently.
Those examples you gave in Auckland, they're all reserves. Can you think of any, what would be ONFs within the Auckland urban area, that is on the urban side of the rural urban boundary, that are not in reserves and therefore have separate policy protection regimes?
I don't know reasonably well, but not that well to answer that question. And just for the shelf, three day submission is that our sea natural features can be protected through another regime, and in the interest of consistency, those are the only four words that make that policy inconsistent with the other four that I quoted earlier. Moving on to ONLs.
Before you do that, Goldsmith, you said that your suggested policy would identify as one of the rationales for the urban growth boundary topographical features. An ONF or indeed an ONL could be such a topographical feature. I take it that your argument will be in the context of the mapping that Mount Iron is not an appropriate topographical feature to serve as a boundary.
Correct. But certainly in principle it could be. I argue that. So, ONLs, 3251, you've had evidence on this, I think, from two or three planners, commissioners, and I actually asked them to address the question of whether inserting the word quality made any meaningful difference. I don't understand the difference between protect the outstanding natural landscapes and protect the quality of the outstanding natural landscapes. It's dancing on the head of a pin in my submission. And I've square bracketed the word of appropriate, which isn't there at the moment and should be, because otherwise the objective says whether it's protect the quality or protect ONLs and ONFs from subdivision use and development. Well, 95% of this district is ONF, is ONL, and under King Salmon you've got to protect it from subdivision use and development. Well, that cuts out farming if you haven't got the word inappropriate. It's just an absolute blanket, virtual blanket prohibition on anything. And my submission is, without the word inappropriate, just contrary to the Act in so many ways that it doesn't matter. I've quoted our seminal decision C180/99 there, I won't read it through. That's just the quote that supports use of the word inappropriate.
Mr. Goldsmith, question for you. Doesn't the Ngāti Karainunu case provide support for an absolute objective? In that case, groundwater quality?
I'm not saying you can't have an absolute objective. What I'm saying is, to have an absolute objective that virtually prohibits subdivision use and development on 95% plus of the Queensland Lakes District is not supported by any analysis, any factual basis, and cannot be sustained.
So, to be clear, your legal submissions are not that you can't have it, but that you shouldn't have it.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. See, I'm not saying you can't, but to do so, you would have to be supported. And I think I come back to this issue a bit later, by an analysis of the entire district, whereby you arrive at a factual conclusion that subdivision use and development in that vast area shouldn't happen.
Can I interrupt a little bit, please? Your figure of 95%, where do you get that from?
Give me, well, just to jump forward, look at my Appendix A. I come to that. Appendix A is the index to your
95% is a guess. Appendix A is the index to your maps. It has all the little squares. Everything outside the squares is ONL. Half the stuff inside the squares is ONL.
Doesn't matter if we have an absolute policy on ONLs that are part of national parks or other conservation land.
And wouldn't be much use for farming ones to do
that. Well, if it's limited to national parks, fine.
And other conservation land.
Oh, well, depending on the status of the conservation land, some conservation land is used. And in fact, no, I'll retract that. National parks maybe, but there's jet boat trips and commercial recreational opportunities that happen in, I suspect, in conservation land. You're protecting these lands from any subdivision use or development. That cuts out cuts out everything. But 95% of the guests can.
I just wanted to make sure that my summarisation was true. Thank you.
It's up there somewhere.
I accept that.
So I quoted the WESI paragraph. I went on at 4.3 and I commented on 6.3.1.2, and this is the policy that says to be assessed against assessment matters, because all subdivision development is appropriate in almost all locations, and then assessment locations will be exceptional cases.
Before you roll on, Mr. Goldsmith, I wanted to put to you that whatever might have been the rights and wrongs of that principle when it was stated in 1999, isn't still good law post-King Salmon?
Good law. I would say it is good law post King Salmon, unless section 6 matters are then trumped, as it were, by a higher order instrument that directs a more stringent level of protection. I mean, the NZCPS went through a whole detail, and as I recollect, included specific policies to avoid certain kinds of development. I can't remember the exact wording, but it was about seeing natural landscapes or whatever. So the higher order CPS, through a statutory process, the RMA provisions here that we're talking about are interpreted through the NZCPS to arrive at directive policy provisions, which were then binding going down the chain. And the NZCPS, in turn, was developed through a process, which would be based upon factual assessments and other things, that arrived at those policy provisions. I think we come back to the same point, that if there's a factual basis, factual analysis for an absolute prohibition, then it can be sustained.
I think I was thinking of the discussion in the Supreme Court, majority of the Supreme Court's decision, about the role of Section 6 matters and the emphasis that the Supreme Court gave to protection first part of Section 5, use, development, and protection. But in relation to your point, pulling back on the specific facts of King Salmon, and the fact that the CPS was an issue, given that the role of the national policy statement is, as you say, to interpret, implement, my word, implement, the purpose of the Act in Part 2, if the NZ is a national instrument, in fact went further than the Act, the Part 2, wouldn't that be an error of law?
I'm not saying it's going further, sir. I believe what I'm saying is that Part 2 talks about preservation and protection from inappropriate subdivision use and development. My setting the NZCPS is that it then said these kind of activities in these specific kind of areas are inappropriate. Therefore, that's consistent with Part 6, because at some point somebody has to decide what is appropriate and what is not appropriate. And I think the NZCPS came down putting to one side the history of it, because the NZCPS was put together before King Salman. But I, as I understand it, the NZCPS effectively and simply has given directions as to what is or is not inappropriate.
Well, on that score, didn't the Supreme Court tell us that in Section 6C, outstanding landscapes, what is inappropriate is anything that doesn't protect the natural landscape in question?
Read the wording, but that still comes down to a judgment on what it replaces one judgment with another judgment. What has adverse effects on the asset in question? I mean, does running heli trips into an area, landing on it, taking photographs, and taking off again, which is a use of land, that be interpreted as being as adversely affecting its natural character?
And
judgment.
And to complete the circle, to be fair to you, I would say that the Supreme Court also said that negligible or temporary effects were probably not adverse effects in the sense that you're using them. So to meet that the very argument that you're making, that if you interpret outstanding and avoid natural land adverse effects on natural landscape to exclude all activities, in effect, then things will come to a grinding halt. And the majority said, no, that didn't follow, because it, as you've rightly said, you have to decide whether there's an adverse effect. If there's no adverse effect, you are protecting the O&M.
Correct. And you have to. Yeah, when we're talking about this, when we're talking about protecting ONLs from subdivision use and development, bear in mind that in this district, high country farming involves burning off, putting the entire sword to the torture in 4 or 5 years in order to grow grass. And that can lead to a range of judgments as to whether that's an appropriate or an inappropriate use, given that you burn off one layer of natural character and then you get it grows up into another layer of natural character. It's not that easy.
And before I invite you to carry on, I'll just put one last proposition to you, that in the context of this panel's deliberations, would a higher, well, I'll put it as a question, be fair, when you're looking for higher order instruments that might prevail, would the operative RPS be in that category, given the obligation to give effect to it?
Yes. It is an obligation. It's kind of a bit funny at the moment, because we've got a proposed RPS that's going through the motions. But, I recently read a fairly interesting opinion by Dr. Royden Somerville, given to the Auckland hearings panel. They're managing to arrive at a conclusion that because of the particular way that statute is written, the particular interpretation, up there is the proposed RPS, not the operative RPS. But the starting point was certainly that it's the operative RPS that you must give effect to.
Yes, I've read Dr. Somerville's opinion, making sense of an impossible position, given that the hearing panel is considering the RPS and the plan at the same time.
It was, yes, it was. It was almost invented. It was interesting. 4.4. I submit two aspects of that policy are inappropriate. The first is a reference to assessment matters, and the second is the severe restriction on development resulting in the exceptional cases statement. My submission in reference to assessment matters confuses a policy with a method. It lacks clarity, because effectively, you can't understand the policy without reference to the assessment matters, which effectively means in this hearing we should be debating the assessment matters, because that's effectively what the policy says. I'm real concerned that it transfers policy guidance into the assessment matters, which is inappropriate. This should be policy, and assessment matters should be a method. And I find you say it's unnecessary because the assessment matters say the same thing. So that whole bit about assessing, that, to my mind, that part of this policy should be deleted. And my second submission...
Or alternatively, if the assessment matters essentially say the same as the policies, should in fact the policies be altered to incorporate the assessment matters and create two different sets of policies depending on the nature of the landscape being dealt with? Because that essentially is what the policy is doing, is saying you've got two sets, different sets of assessment matters, and you use one set for ONLs and one set for rural landscape.
Yes, but the policy just says, you must assess them against the assessment matters down there.
Mm. But if the policies were set out under that objective, then you would have to assess them under those policies anyway, and you wouldn't need the assessment matters. Isn't that the reality of Section 104?
No. My understanding of assessment matters is that they are a guidance, they're a method to guide application of the policies.
I can't remember the name of the decision I just read recently that said the assessment matters are essential policies.
Well, in which case, if we're going to be, you know, assessing, if this policy is then linked to assessment matters, which in turn are policies, and effectively, because they're referenced here, are policies at this level, then we should have the assessment matters in front of us, and we should be debating the whole lot.
Well, I don't know. I was just raising whether they should be included here at this point.
Well, when we come
or
to
whether they should be in the rural zone, which is the only zone where it's applicable, as policies.
Well, perhaps to go slightly sideways to what I'll be submitting when we come to the rural living areas, I have a strong concern that as we stand at the moment, in the landscape section, there's an almost complete lack of policy guidance for rural living development in the rural area, and there's almost nothing until we get to the assessment matters.
Mr. Gosford, if you deleted that reference to assessment here, then you've only got the assessment matters sitting there. You've got assessment matters with no link to policy. If you just delete it, what would be the situation there?
Well, you have whatever policy is in the policies. I mean, this particular 6312, I mean, all it does is two things. It says, assess proposals against the assessment matters. That's just a direction. And then it makes a statement, which is a completely different issue, that development is inappropriate other than exceptional cases. I'm attacking the first half and saying, well, the first half doesn't actually do anything, because when you get down to the assessment matters, in fact, in our current plan, says that all applications must be assessed against these assessment matters. So I'm not exactly sure what this direction achieves, except it appears to be intended to replace policy. And the policies for ONLs and ONS, if there's going to be Chapter 6 landscape policies, and there are, they're in Chapter 6. The assessment matters are a method to help you interpret the policies. I think it's dangerous to confuse the two.
And then the second part, in my submission, the exceptional cases, which is back to what we were talking about before, cannot reasonably be imposed on all of the ONLs in the Queensland Lakes District.
Well, I want to cut to the chase on this one. Mm-hmm. You refer extensively to the Wesse decision. And I'm not sure if it was exactly that decision, but one of the other decisions out of the series that the court put on the operative district plan inserted 1.5.3, Roman 3, discretionary activities, little 3, because in or on outstanding natural landscapes and features, the relevant activities are inappropriate in almost all locations within the zone, particularly the Wakatipu Basin or in the Upper Clutha area. Now that is in the operative plan, so why can it not be in the proposed plan?
I believe that the reference to exceptional is more stringent.
But isn't that a factual statement, a logical statement, that if inappropriate in almost all locations, then they've all the exceptions?
Stand by my submission, that this terminology is elevating what was a very stringent regime in the ONLWB.
But it says in the Oxford plan, also the inner upper clutha. So while the other side of the coin is that the court had a lot less evidence on the ONLs district-wide, from memory, was focused on the Waitapu Basin, so it was in a better position to deal with those matters there.
Yes.
I suspect that that's the real reason for the distinction in the provisions, not the fact that somehow these ONLs outside of the Wakatipu Basin are of a lesser quality and therefore less important, which is the implication of your submission.
With respect, sir, I don't believe that's how Seaman 8.99 is correctly interpreted. In that case did not say that the rest of the ONLs were of less quality or of less importance. What it said was two things. One, the development pressure of the basin is so strong and the amount of development that's happened has got to a point where almost no more can be tolerated. And part of the rationale for that was the fact that it was within the 3 kilometres or something, you know, it was in a basin, kind of within 3 kilometres and looked at from the whole basin and close to the whole basin, so it was a geographical context to it and a development pressure context to it that led the court to devise the policies that I actually attached to the decision, just in case the other commissioners haven't seen it. So, based upon a factual analysis and on a lot of evidence, it devised a regime for the Wakatipu Basin, which was, and I've said in my submissions, for practical purposes, it's a higher standard than non-compliant. It's virtually impossible. Not quite impossible, because it might have been one or two, but in the Wakatipu Basin, the policy standard is that high that it's almost impossible. The court didn't put the same policy basis on the rest of the district. My submission because it didn't have the evidence to do so. And the provision you referred to is a funny little guidance note somewhere. It still isn't a policy or an objective. It's just
another provision in the plan.
Another provision in the plan. And
I think this panel has to be careful that at the end of the day, restrictions have to be justified. And given the extent of the O&L that I've kind of tried to illustrate in my copying out the index, you know, to have a policy regime that is so tight that covers all of that district without the landscape analysis or the use analysis or anything else to support it,
is
extreme.
And I think Commissioner Robinson touched on this. Is the Wessie decision really relevant to us? That was 17 years ago on an appeal against a plan which lacked any provision for landscape protection. We are in a different position now. There has been any amount of work done in the intervening period on the landscapes in the district. It may not be to the fine-grained analysis that some submitters, such as Mr. Howard, who was here this morning, my wife, but it has probably had the greatest examination by independent hearing commissioners and the Environment Court of outstanding natural landscapes than any other district in the country. So aren't we in a position now somewhat different from 1999?
First of all, we're clearly in a different position. Time has moved on, everything you've said is correct. But secondly, you still have to end up making decisions and crafting policies and putting up a regime informed by the evidence before you. I'm not sure in that exercise how much assistance you get from all those different decisions and analysis over the intervening period, other than possibly to arrive at a conclusion. Other than to be able to test based upon analysis as to whether the current regime has worked. For example, Dr. Reid in her evidence, or one of her reports, expressed the view that the ONLWB regime had worked pretty well in Waterloo Basin. It had achieved its, she said something like that, it's worked well. I don't know whether you have any, and let's accept for the moment that at the moment we have the ONLWB, and we have the O&L district wide. And it's been in operation for 15 years, 16, 17 years. If you have evidence before you that the current ONLDW regime hasn't worked to protect the O&Ls, and that there are threats to the O&Ls due to that policy regime being insufficiently stringent, which would kind of surprise me because it's pretty stringent, then you may have evidence before you which may lead you to say, well, we know that regime, it wasn't quite strong enough, it's broken down there and there and there, and on the evidence before us, we need to elevate and make it tougher.
I'm not convinced of that submission. It is the same subsection of Section 6 that we're dealing with throughout the district. Doesn't that suggest that throughout the district we should take the same approach? Because the ONLs are outstanding natural landscapes of the district, not subsets of the district.
I'm trying to avoid the danger of repeating myself. I come back to the point that C-100R-99, based upon a factual assessment and evidence, and site visits, arrived at a conclusion that a particularly stringent regime was needed in the Waterloo Basin.
And a lack of evidence outside of the Waterloo Basin.
That's fair enough. And if you have evidence beyond that before you,
your submission is that our conclusions should be guided by the fact that in 1999 there was a lack of evidence before the Environment Court in certain parts of the district.
No, what I'm saying is, since that current regime was put in place, you've had 15 years of development pressure and applications and so on and so forth, and if the monitoring reports and the studies that the council has done has revealed problems that need to be addressed, then you may have the evidence to say, well, we need to do X to address this problem. And what I'm saying, I'm not sure you have that evidence, I don't think I've seen it, but what I'm also saying to you is that, which is kind of the reverse side of the coin, in 1999, based on certain evidence and certain facts, we ended up with a certain regime. And it's very stringent. It's very tough. And I'm not sure that you can just then, with a stroke of a pen, without any basis, then roll that regime across the district.
Mr. Goldsmith, can I suggest to you that the other thing that has changed since 1999 is King Salmon. In 1999, it was generally thought that the reference in 6C to inappropriate subdivision use and development was capable of conferring discretion that could be exercised by a reference back to a broad judgment. The Nakara wind farm was consented on that basis right next to coastal ONL. King Salmon says no, inappropriate doesn't refer back to section 5. It makes the provision, with great respect to the Supreme Court, circular, I think, because it refers back to what it is that's protecting. Inappropriate is anything that's not protecting. So that whatever the merits of the submission you've made to the chair, in response to the chair's question, King Salmon is arguably a key distinguishing factor that the Supreme Court have told us that Section 6C means that those once classified as outstanding natural landscapes, those landscapes have to be protected, end of story, and the plan has to recognise and provide for that protection. And coming back to the earlier discussion, the only thing it doesn't need to protect against are activities that don't actually have an adverse effect that is minor or more than minor. I'm not sure which the majority said, or which are temporary. So I'll put that proposition to you.
And then we run the danger, don't we, do we not, that if you end up with that, whatever the percentage is, of the district under that stringent regime, then what is it you can do out there? Across the range of farming and commercial creation and tourism and a whole bunch of other things. What is it you can, that they have, you have to be able to have a basis for judgment still on what is appropriate and what is not appropriate.
Well, I hear what you say, but the Supreme Court have told us that that's not the law, and I think that whatever else this panel is going to do, it's not going to write its decision that the Supreme Court was wrong.
I would accept that.
About that. seconded several times.
the other proposition I've put to you is that what I might call an appeal to common sense, and that's not to deprecate the quality of the submission you've just made, because I think there is a lot that could be said at a common sense level. What you put to us, isn't that also exactly the argument that Man of War Station is running so far unsuccessfully why they're going to have another go at the Court of Appeal in the middle of the year, that the policy regime follows automatically from, they're opposing the contention that the policy regime follows automatically from a classification of outstandingness, as I say, thus far unsuccessfully through the Environment Court and the High Court. So the amount of authority is weighing up, or the weight is increasing, that the proposition you put to us is not correct.
Perhaps I can take on board your comments, Commissioners, because I am going to come back. I won't think about it.
Can I add another point there? From my understanding, the Wachtapu ONLs were, you were saying, the student was because, A, we know more about it, B, the greater government pressure. You've said yourself that we're looking at the district plan that it's likely to go for 20 years. We already know there's more pressure in the upper critical than there has been in the past. That pressure is likely to grow, isn't it, in the next 20 years? Would we not be remiss in our duty as commissioners to not give the adequate level of protection now for the next 20 years, acknowledging that there's second plank of a reason for the Wachtapu ONLs, given what you say is that the stringent level of protection should also apply?
I'm not sure I'd agree with you in terms of the evidence of pressure in this area, even compared to 20 years ago, what was the base? I mean,
we've got another 20 years to go.
Yes, I know. But, yeah.
So, would it? Yeah.
Yeah. No,
I think we've probably got
you said you cut to the chase. I think in 410, I